Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
I heard somebody say, you know, no coach had to give any inspirational speeches because he clearly was the leader in that locker room. And when he talked, everybody listened.
Junior Seau's suicide on Wednesday shocked people inside and beyond the sports world. Ahead on Only a Game, San Diegans remember the former NFL linebacker and philanthropist, even as many wonder how Seau's death might change attitudes toward brain injuries in athletes. Also ahead, the suspension of four players as a result of the NFL's investigation of the Saints' bounty hunting scheme. Race fans enjoy a leisurely pre-derby morning at Churchill Downs, and mental athletes amaze at the U.S. Memory Championship. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. San Diego is saying goodbye to a sports icon this week. The residents were shocked to learn of the suicide of former Chargers linebacker Junior Seau. The charismatic linebacker played 13 years for his hometown Chargers, helping the team get to the Super Bowl in 1995. He also played in Miami and New England. Eric Anderson of member station KPBS in San Diego says Seau reached beyond the football field to touch lives across the city.
If there was one moment that captured the grief caused by Seau's death, it happened mid-morning on Wednesday. Louisa Seau, Junior's mom, approached television cameras outside of her son's home. She spoke briefly of their last conversations and then was overwhelmed.
He never said something for me. Junior, hey, why are you never telling me you're going? And I pray to God, take me. Take me, leave my son alone.
Fans gathered at the home all day. They left flowers, figurines, and prayers. On the beach nearby, several people used large stones to create a cross. They scrawled R.I.P. in the sand, along with the number 55. Seau made the uniform number famous when he played for the Chargers. His death also drew fans to the San Diego restaurant bearing his name, which had shut down for the day. Carolyn Mitchell says she will remember his personality.
A big face and a big smile. A kind person.
Mitchell brought a small bouquet of yellow flowers. She left them at the front door of the eatery and then paused.
I had shared a prayer to myself and to him. That may he rest in peace, and whatever was bothering him, I hope that he find peace now, and I prayed for his family, reassuring that everything will be okay.
Seau was known for his relentless pursuit of opposing football players on the field and for his relentless fundraising off the field. He raised more than $4 million for the children's charity that bears his name. Ruben Escobosa met Seau through a business partner. He called the death a shock for the community.
He was bigger than life, and he was very proud of his roots, specifically in Oceanside in his high school, the Oceanside Pirates, and his heritage. You know, he's very proud and promoted and supported his Samoan heritage, which I think is very important.
For Only a Game, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
Junior Seau's death has provoked many people who knew him and many more who didn't to celebrate his admirable qualities. He loved the game he played, and he inspired those who played beside him. What pro athletes admire most in their peers is longevity, and Junior Seau certainly achieved that. The average NFL career lasts a couple of years. Seau played from 1990 through 2009. He was dedicated to achieving excellence through hard work. According to some of his former teammates in New England, the trainers in the Patriots' weight room complained about how early Seau would arrive to begin his workouts. He was a thoughtful friend. Robert Kraft, the owner of the team for which Seau last played, spoke this week about how touched he was by a note Seau wrote him when Kraft's wife passed away. But although many of those who thought they knew him best have said they saw no indication that he would kill himself, that is what Junior Seau did. In so doing, he joined the many ex-NFL players whose deaths have provoked serious concern about the damage done in the workplace they chose. This means that those celebrating the life of Junior Seau cannot be content with celebration. They must also consider the relationship of his loss to the daily business of the game in which he so impressed them and distinguished himself. Like Dave Duerson in February of 2011, Seau shot himself in the chest. Duerson left a note directing that his brain should be examined by those investigating chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the concussion-related condition that has been present in the brains of other ex-NFL players who have killed themselves or otherwise died prematurely. No such note has been found where Junior Seau died, but his family has indicated that his brain will be made available for study. The list of ex-NFL players who have killed themselves or died in bizarre accidents or suffered from dementia, memory dysfunction, and depression grows, as does the number of ex-players currently suing the National Football League. About 1,500 ex-players have joined those suits, which contend that the league has consciously failed to protect the health and welfare of the players, despite knowing of the damage being done to the brains of those players engaged in their work. The league denies those charges. Junior Seau was 43 years old. The results of the examination of his brain will probably be available in 4 to 6 weeks. On Wednesday, the NFL announced the suspensions of 4 players who, according to the league, participated in the Saints' bounty hunting scheme. Linebacker Jonathan Vilma was suspended for the entire 2012 season. Lesser suspensions were handed down to 3 other current and former Saints. On Friday, the NFL Players Association appealed and challenged the authority of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, citing the terms of the latest collective bargaining agreement, which, they assert, prohibits Goodell from unilaterally punishing players for conduct prior to August 4th. Andrew Brandt is an NFL business analyst for ESPN and former vice president of the Green Bay Packers. Andrew, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be with you again, Bill.
What is your view of the NFLPA's contention that the latest collective bargaining agreement limits the commissioner's power to punish players for whatever happened before August 4th when that agreement went into effect?
I think this is going to be a stretch, Bill. I think the idea that there's pre-CBA conduct is going to be a stretch, because what was written in that clause that they talk about, this Article 3, was that the NFL will not sue based on what happened before August 4th, 2011, when the CBA was put in place. That was really a legal argument. You know, that was an argument that we're not going to file any more lawsuits, that this Brady v. NFL is going to go away, we're having a global settlement here. So the NFLPA is trying to use that to say that should apply to conduct, including conduct about bounties and pay for injuries and those kind of things. Ultimately, it's going to come down to an arbitrator. The one thing about the language that may help the NFLPA is it's pretty broad. It's not the strictest release you've ever seen, so the broad language might help the NFLPA, but clearly the intent was a legal release about lawsuits, not about discipline.
The NFL issued a statement in response to the appeal. What is the league's counterargument?
Well, they didn't get into the specific legal and arbitration arguments, but they certainly feel that they're going to win in arbitration, as we expect. They suggest these arguments are flawed. They suggest that Article 3, in terms of the pre-CBA conduct, was meant for a totally different purpose and not to cause immunity for conduct such as injuring their fellow players, and they put that kind of language in there to make it strong. They also feel that they will be upheld in terms of the collective bargaining process being the way to give the commissioner control over the conduct of the game, not any other fashion which the NFLPA has been suggesting.
In your article on ESPN.com, you point out that the NFL Players Association is appealing the suspension of 4 of its own members for attempting to harm other members. This does put a union in a difficult position, doesn't it?
It does, Bill. They're representing the hunted and the hunters, and what they continue to try to say is it's not about that. What they do is try to unite everyone against their common enemy, it would seem, the NFL, rather than conquer and divide, which they think the NFL is trying to do to them. They're trying to get everyone to fight the NFL's process in doing this. Where we are, and this is part of the NFL statement, Bill, the NFL statement says they have not put any facts in dispute. Mm-hmm. And in their arbitrations, they're not saying we didn't do this. They're not saying these players did not intend to injure. What they're saying is it's a procedural thing, and there should be a different person hearing the appeal. So the NFL is obviously frustrated, and I guess my comment on all this, Bill, is that although we have a 10-year labor agreement, we hardly have labor peace, and the adversarial relationship between the union and the league continue.
Of the four suspended players, linebacker Jonathan Vilma was hit the hardest. Pending appeal, he will miss the entire 2012 season and forfeit his $3.3 million salary. Some people have suggested that Vilma was unfairly scapegoated. Do you agree?
Really tough question to answer without seeing the evidence. I think this is a frustration of the union as well. They continue to say they have not seen all the evidence. Hmm. But they've suggested that he was kind of the ringleader, that he was the deputy to coordinator Greg Williams in putting the money in and getting the money shelled out to players. If, in fact, he was the ringleader in all this, and if, in fact, we know that Greg Williams is suspended indefinitely, you can see the argument. If there was not a translation between saying these things and doing these things, then I think he has a better argument on appeal.
Anthony Hargrove got an 8-game suspension. He now plays for Green Bay, where you were once a vice president. How do you imagine that suspension is going over with the Green Bay Packers staff?
I think any good front office has to project for what might happen. And when they signed Anthony Hargrove, I think it was in late March, this was already in the news. And on March 2nd is when it all came out about what was happening, and there's a 3-year investigation, and they had to know that Anthony Hargrove was part of that defense. They're prepared for that, and they obviously drafted some interior defensive linemen, perhaps with that in mind.
There's been some suggestion, some analysis that says the Saints likewise prepared for what was going to happen to their team. I wonder how you expect New Orleans to perform next season, given all the upheaval.
Yeah, Bill, those are going to have the chip on their shoulder. They're going to have these rallying cries throughout their locker room. They don't even have a real coach in the first 6 games of the season. Their interim coach is going to be suspended. Obviously, they only are losing 2 players. Now, those are 2 key players in Vilma and Will Smith. A bigger issue for them has nothing to do with the bounties, of course. They have an unsigned quarterback, although he has a franchise tag, which inures him to the team for 1 more year. But Drew Brees is currently without a contract, and that's something they should be focusing on, perhaps even more than this bounty situation.
Andrew Brandt is an NFL business analyst for ESPN. Andrew, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Staples High School in Westport, Connecticut may have perfectly adequate athletic teams, but their attempt to achieve notoriety in the Guinness World Record book will not depend on runs batted in or handsprings turned by energetic cheerleaders. Instead, Staples High wants the Guinness people to certify that no other secondary school has ever had as many as 16 sets of twins in the same academic year. According to Guinness, the current record is the 13 sets of twins who graduated in 2010 from Pomperpaugh High, which is also in Connecticut, where there must be something in the water. Since 16 is 3 more than 13, or 6 more, sort of, since it's twins we're talking about, Staples High should grab the twins record, unless 3 or more of the potential record setters transfer to private school before somebody can take a picture.
We go together, we're 2 of a kind. No use protesting.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a monochromatic zero-sum look at the team in pinstripes. But first, today at Churchill Downs, gemologist Bodemeister and Doulahan are among the favorites that will peel out of the starting gate in the 138th running of the Kentucky Derby. Those magical 2 minutes lure a couple hundred thousand spectators each year, and while many delight in the parties and the frantic mile-and-a-quarter-long race, some fans enjoy the Derby's quieter side in the week leading up to the first jewel in horse racing's Triple Crown. From Louisville, Ann Marshall has the story.
As about a dozen horses coast through a morning jog, Carl Diamond, a sleepy-eyed 8-year-old in shorts and red sneakers, stands on a bright green aluminum chair to catch a glimpse of Churchill Downs' famed track. In a few days, this seat, just inches from the giant mile-long oval, will cost a few thousand dollars. Carl's mother, Susan, holds his younger sister as all three take in a pre-Derby morning workout.
Look, here comes the fast ones.
Carl's head swivels left. His eyes catch the orange glow of sunrise before following a tight percussive pack of three thoroughbreds and their crouched riders. The horses wear red silks, not the yellow, indicating Derby contenders.
How did they not make it to the Derby?
Maybe they did.
But the ones with the yellow is
supposed
to.
Oh, they didn't
to.
Have yellow? There's, I guess, blue. Probably 10 or 12 races on Derby Day, so lots of horses racing.
This early morning trek to Churchill Downs has become a family tradition. Susan and her husband will usually dress up and head to Kentucky Oaks the day before Derby when fillies race, but the kids, they stay home. It's more of an adult scene. This morning as dawn breaks, stadium lights pierce a gentle gray mist, but the betting windows remain dark. Mint juleps, not now. Instead?
Well, muffins and fruit and juice. We're kind of taking it easy and just enjoying some things that we brought instead of going upstairs to the big spread.
Churchill Downs hosts a generous buffet breakfast for about $30, but Mary Eckler opts to lounge with three friends and a Tupperware bowl full of strawberries. All four women live in Louisville, so come the first week in May, they juggle out-of-town visitors with parades and parties. At least for a few hours, it's nice to watch trainers and horses run in circles.
You know, it's kind of like when you have a party and everything's ready, so you just sit back and enjoy one another before the guests come.
But the anticipation escalates even as fans relax trackside.
I think you can feel the excitement for the race building as you watch the horses working out, and it's just fun to see them.
It helps you get into the spirit of the Derby. If you make an appearance here sometime during Derby Week. Yeah.
It's our little secret.
Don't tell a bunch of people or it'll be packed.
Yeah, don't put this on the air, okay?
Of course, not everyone arrives looking for a breather. Under a floppy green hat, binoculars nearby, Duanice Kessler from Pennsylvania is searching for talent. A fan with encyclopedic knowledge of horse racing, she knows every top contender's owner, bloodline, and racing stats. A lot of this comes from hanging out, watching horses get schooled and walking the paddock or cataloging each elegant stride.
Oh, I think you can get a better look at the horses in the morning as they're galloping. Because in the race, you just see the horse come out. You may see them warm up or they go around toward the back of the track, and then you just see them zoom by at the race, so you don't get to see the horses as well. I mean, we do watch the races, too.
Trying to capture the weekend's champions, it can happen. Mark McEwen, standing a few feet away, knows that. For the last few years, he's taken his 3-year-old grandson, Landon, to morning practice. The blonde toddler buries himself into his grandpa's shoulder as Mark recalls a chance encounter.
True story, last year we were here and the horse that won the Oaks came over to the rail. We had him sitting on the rail. He got to pet it on its nose. And we said, we've got to bet that horse tomorrow. We didn't bet it and it won. So seriously, you never know.
Maybe Landon will touch the Derby winner on this morning, proving that when it comes to the most exciting 2 minutes in sports, great moments can come from simply taking some time. For Only a Game, I'm Ann Marshall in Louisville.
When horse racing's single most celebrated day comes to a close, attention should be paid to a couple of troubling circumstances connected with the racing industry. The injury rate among horses seems to be rising, particularly at the less celebrated tracks in places like New Mexico and Arizona. And officials at the New York Racing Association have apparently failed to abide by a directive to reduce the track's share of so-called exotic wagers. Two key members of the NYRA have been placed on administrative leave in connection with that, quote, oversight. You'll no doubt hear more about these dark matters when the rosy glow of the Derby and the strains of my old Kentucky home have faded away. Batting practice is generally a relaxed interlude of little consequence featuring pitches meant to be hit before guys like Mariano Rivera start throwing pitches meant to be missed. Except that there aren't really any guys like Mariano Rivera, or no closers anyway. He has saved 608 games. He has 5 World Series championship rings, and as of Thursday evening during batting practice in Kansas City, he has a torn anterior cruciate ligament incurred during the pursuit of a fly ball. For many years, Mariano Rivera has been difficult to root against, even for people predisposed to hope the Yankees will lose. He has displayed the qualities most admirable in pro athletes. No closer has been more successful. He's been a model of consistency, as the saying goes, though for him there should probably be another saying, since for Rivera, consistency means that since 1996, his earned run average has rarely strayed north of 2. Beyond that, at least to those of us watching from a distance, Rivera has embodied the quality we like to think we'd manage to convey if the spotlight ever fell on us for all the right reasons. He has appeared to be a fellow who simply does his job without feeling the need to thump his chest or otherwise draw attention to his achievements in any way other than piling them up, one after another, day after day. Mariano Rivera is 42 years old, but his performance hadn't declined. He'd already saved 5 games this spring. He saved 44 games last season. The autobiography of the late great pitcher Satchel Paige was titled Maybe I'll Pitch Forever. It had begun to seem as if Mariano Rivera might do that, and he announced yesterday that he will come back. Write it down in big letters, he said. I hope he makes it. Perhaps it's sentimental to think so, but it seems as if somebody who's been that good for that long ought to have the opportunity to retire on his own terms, in his own time. Damn Yankees, a new book edited by Rob Flader, is subtitled 24 Major League Writers on the World's Most Loved and Hated Team. That subtitle suggests that the book couldn't have been written about any other ball club, and perhaps that's true. Baseball fans love the Yankees or they hate the Yankees, but they do not ignore the Yankees, or at least none of the writers included in this anthology did. Rob Flader joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Rob, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Good to be here.
And sitting there beside Rob is Will Leach, whose essay, An Innocent Abroad, is included in the collection. Will, welcome back to the program.
Of course. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Rob, did you find it difficult to balance Yankee lovers with Yankee haters as you were putting this collection together?
Not in the least, no. I think everybody has a really strong opinion about the Yankees. In fact, it tends to polarize pretty much everybody in the world. So when I set out to tell both sides of the story to include the whole range of opinions, I had no trouble finding people at either extreme.
Will, your essay, An Innocent Abroad, ends with thousands of fans in Yankee Stadium cruelly chanting the name of an opposing player who had recently died of a heart attack. Why did you end it there?
I'm from the Midwest, so you know I grew up in the Midwest, and how Yankee Stadium kind of, in a lot of ways, represented in a way I would have never expected, kind of my growing up experience. But then when I actually took my parents there, I'm like, guys, this is Yankee Stadium. This can be like our hometown, like our tiny hometown. I tried to make this analogy to them, and then they started chanting Daryl Kyle when they saw our Cardinals hats. So I wanted to kind of end on that kind of just so you know, if in case you think you're getting too nice or too cute in Yankee Stadium, they're not. They're still pretty mean sometimes.
Well, as you say, you're not a native New Yorker. When you were approached about contributing to this book, did a strong feeling about the Yankees immediately become apparent to you?
You know, it's funny. I was joking with Rob that I feel like I am the most Switzerland when it comes to the Yankees, because to me, you know, I grew up in Central Illinois. The Yankees in New York were basically China. To me, they were Mars. You know, they were an entire universe altogether. My experience with the Yankees has always been as this kind of outsider and as this kind of like appreciating them as a cultural artifact, but not actually realizing that I live in the same physical universe as they do. So that, you know, it was strange. Like so for me to move here and then go to Yankee Stadium for the first time, it was like stepping into the church of someone that has a different denomination than you.
Mm. Rob, I want to talk a little about novelist Pete Dexter's essay, which is titled The Errors of Our Ways. He refers to George Steinbrenner as, quote, one of those men whose death leaves the world feeling like a safer place. He focuses on Chuck Knoblauch, in whose rise and fall Dexter finds both comedy and horror. Did you have any idea what you were going to get when you invited Pete Dexter to be involved in this project?
Well, all I knew, and anyone who's ever worked with Peter knows him or even read him, knows that you never have any idea what's coming. You know it's likely to be brilliant and very probably funny. But, you know, he got interested in Knoblauch because he got very sick, and a guy who was an incredibly prolific and diligent writer, wrote every day of his life, after he got recovered from this illness, couldn't write, found he couldn't do what he did every day of his life. And he called one day and said, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Chuck Knoblauch, who, of course, woke up one day and couldn't throw the ball from second to first. So that was the starting point. You know, I fell out of my chair laughing when I got the piece at first. It's just an unbelievable, brilliant, hilarious piece.
Rob, I'm also curious about whether you've heard from readers who have said there are either too many essays in the book by Yankee lovers or too many by Yankee haters, something along that line.
No, I haven't. I haven't heard from any readers. I heard from various friends and associates who are Red Sox fans saying, well, you know, nice try. You got a taste of it in there. I felt like I made a concerted effort to go right to the belly of the beast and ask several writers, distinguished writers from Boston, to contribute to the book, to be certain that we covered that, you know, that part of the spectrum. Yeah, Charlie Pierce, Lee Monfil, Bill James works for the Red Sox. I mean, he's probably the greatest baseball writer of our time, the most influential, certainly, but he works for the Red Sox. So I made a real effort to cover the spectrum and to go right to the heart of it, and I haven't heard any complaints from readers, you know, that we failed to air that side of the equation.
You know, it does strike me, based on the conversation that we've been having, but correct me if I'm wrong, can either of you imagine a book like this being written about any other team?
I would have to think the Red Sox would become the closest. You know, the way Red Sox fans are often about their team, it might be both too tragic and too terrifying. And too, like, I feel like this book, like the Yankees are easier to be funny about.
Mm. Right. Because Red Sox fans really like the suffering. I think the Cubs are interesting because I guess
nobody hates the Cubs, though. Well,
Cardinal fans hate the Cubs.
Right. They're obliged to
and
hate
White Sox,
the Cubs.
And White Sox fans, right.
No, White Sox fans don't hate the Cubs. They pretend the Cubs aren't there. They pretend it's a one-team
yes,
city.
I think the Cubs return the favor.
That's exactly right. My experience as well.
So probably, I think you're right, Bill. Nobody in baseball is so polarizing. I mean, there are other teams that are interesting, and fans in various places have complicated and interesting feelings about them. In sports, maybe the closest thing is the Dallas Cowboys, who are loved and hated for some of the same reasons as the Yankees, I think, polarized the world. But but no, you're right. I don't think there's another baseball team that divides the world this cleanly.
Rob Flader is the editor of Damn Yankees, 24 Major League Writers on the World's Most Loved and Hated Team. The book is published by HarperCollins, and Rob Flader joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bill.
And also joining me was Will Leach, whose essay appears in the book. Will, thank you for speaking with me.
Of course. Thank you very much as well.
You're listening to Only a Game. Ask most Americans to name one great chess player, and they will answer Bobby Fischer, and that's in part because Fischer was, for a time, number one in the world, and in part because he was spectacularly eccentric. Hikaru Nakamura became a chess master earlier than Bobby Fischer achieved that distinction. Nakamura became a grandmaster at 15. He beat Fischer to that level, too. And now Mr. Nakamura is just 10 points shy of the record total of 2,785 points Fischer earned. During the U.S. Chess Championship, which begins on Monday in St. Louis, Bobby Fischer's record could be eclipsed by Hikaru Nakamura, who joins me on the line. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Let's assume that you pass Bobby Fischer's point total during the U.S. Championships currently underway. What would that mean to you?
It's certainly a significant mark in the sense that becoming the highest-ranked American chess player in history, once you achieve that, no one can take it away from you. But it's a different era now, so even though I'm breaking the record, it's not quite as big of a deal, I guess, you know, as, say, becoming world champion, for instance.
I understand that you're also a fan of the Vancouver Canucks of the National Hockey League, and your beloved Canucks were dumped from the first round of the playoffs this year despite having the best regular season record. I gotta wonder, is there a chess equivalent, I don't know, the Nimzo Indian defense or something that can be applied on the ice? What would you tell them to do?
They simply don't perform at the highest level when you're in the playoffs, which is the most important point of the season. And for me, it's much different to compare it to chess, where when I'm in that moment, that situation during a very big game, I'm just performing at my absolute best. And it would really be nice if the Canucks could do the same in hockey one of these years.
Comparisons between you and Bobby Fischer are perhaps inevitable. Fischer became world champion when he was 29. Do you feel any pressure to achieve that distinction before you reach that age, that is, within the next 6 years?
I don't feel pressure. I think for me, the main goal that I have, or at least really what I aspire to, is to raise the level of chess. I mean, what was great about Fischer is that when he became world champion is that chess was being covered everywhere. It was in all the major newspapers. It was on TV. And if I can do every little bit that I can, I mean, that's really what I hope for, is that chess can become very popular going forward.
Hikaru Nakamura will be competing in the U.S. Chess Championship, which begins Monday in St. Louis. Mr. Nakamura, good luck, and thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
McDonald's, an official sponsor of the Olympic Games since 1976, will certainly make its presence known at the London Games this summer. The London venue will feature four McDonald's, and one of them will be a two-story cathedral-like restaurant that seats 1,500 customers. This does not please Terrence Stevenson, a spokesperson for the Academy of Royal Medical Colleges. Dr. Stevenson has said that he doubts many athletes will be chowing down on Big Macs before competing, but he worries that Britons, about one quarter of whom are obese, will be confused by the association of McDonald's with some of the world's greatest athletes, and that they will try to become fit and competitive by scarfing down chicken McNuggets. London Olympic organizers have tried to shut up Dr. Stevenson by offering to supersize his fries, but so far it hasn't worked. Nah, they didn't really try to do that. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Don't forget to stay tuned for the U.S. Memory Championships. But first, Charlie Pierce, on the road in Nebraska this week, joins me for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I'm sorry, who are you again?
I knew that was going to happen. Boy, you talk about teeing one up. There it was. Former NFL star linebacker Junior Seau committed suicide on Wednesday. Charlie was 43 years old. He'd retired in 2009. How, if at all, do you think this sad event fits into the ongoing discussion of the post-football lives of NFL players?
Well, it makes it ongoing, and it intensifies it because of the stature Seau had in the game. There has got to be, at this point, a serious reconsideration on the part of everybody involved with football, down to the level of the fan, about reconsidering your affection for this game. I mean, Junior Seau was not merely an enormously talented player. He was an enormously popular player and an enormously friendly player and a terrific presence in the game. And for this to have happened to him, is I think, going to put an even more intense level of scrutiny on what's going on here.
Commissioner Goodell finally brought down the hammer on some of the players involved in the New Orleans Saints' so-called bounty program. The defensive captain of the team, Jonathan Vilma, was suspended for an entire season. Fair punishment?
I think so, and I think that the NFLPA is well within its rights to appeal this. There are a lot of people who are outraged that they're actually, you know, behaving like a labor union. But I don't think the appeal is going to be upheld. I think Jonathan Vilma is going to lose the season, and I think he should.
At the end of the NFL draft, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers made a surprising pick. Were you moved by their selection of Eric LeGrand, the former Rutgers player whose career on the football field was ended by a spinal cord injury?
Yeah, it's really kind of a terrific moment for Tampa Bay. They're gonna fly him down. They gave him a contract. They're gonna give him a number. They're gonna send him a jersey, and he says he wanted to play and become a sportscaster. So who knows? You may be looking at the future voice of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
The Chicago Bulls, which had been a favorite to capture the coveted Larry O'Brien trophy, lost star guard Derrick Rose to a torn ACL last Saturday. The Bulls are currently down 2-1 to Philadelphia in the NBA's first playoff round. Do they stand any chance without Rose?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think Philadelphia is going to get to the mountaintop and discover that it's very hard to breathe, basically. Now, I think if Philadelphia gets to the brink of beating Chicago, I think you're going to have at least one game where Philadelphia falls apart. But it's going to be a long road for Chicago, and I don't expect them to get much further.
The New York Knicks continued to make news this week, Charlie, but for the wrong reason. In going down 3-0 to the Miami Heat on Thursday night, they set an NBA record for most consecutive playoff losses, 13 straight over the last 11 years. What happened to what seemed like a promising Knicks squad?
They ran into the best team in the league right now, and Miami has decided to commit its enormous talents to playing defense as well as offense, basically, and the Knicks were not in any way prepared for that.
Amari Stoudemire hopes to return from his most recent injury to play in tomorrow's game between the Knicks and the Miami Heat. This might be considered more heroic if he hadn't caused the injury himself.
Yeah, it's kind of a very stupid way to get hurt during the playoffs. He punched out a glass case in frustration after the Knicks lost a game. It's one of those things where, like, your teammates turn their back to you when you walk in the locker room and go into their lockers.
In the NHL, the Los Angeles Kings, having dispatched number 1 seed Vancouver in the first round, are now up 3-0 over number 2 seed St. Louis. A number 8 seed has never won the Stanley Cup, but what do you think? The Kings?
Well, I think the Western Conference of the National Hockey League is a landfill, and I think anybody who comes out of there isn't going to win the Stanley Cup anyway.
Yankees closer and future Baseball Hall of Famer Mariano Rivera tore his ACL on Thursday while shagging balls in the outfield during batting practice, and there is speculation that this will mark the end of the 42-year-old reliever's career. That would be a shame, wouldn't it?
It would be terrible, but I have a bigger question. What is a 42-year-old reliever doing shagging flies?
It's what they do during
batting
practice.
I know it's what they do, but it's what they should. I would wrap Mariano Rivera in bubble wrap between appearances. I mean, the guy hasn't gained an ounce. It's not like he's out of shape. I don't get this one at all, and it would be a terrible way for that career to end. But you know, maybe they need a head start on, you know, chiseling the plaque for Cooperstown.
Charlie, we failed to mention Phil Humber's perfect game last week, and several listeners, most of them probably White Sox fans, gave us a hard time, so I'm not going to fail to mention the no-hitter Jared Weaver threw on behalf of the Angels on Wednesday night. Do 2 no-hitters in 2 weeks make a no-hitter seem somehow less impressive?
No, not to me. I've always been very impressed with no-hitters, to be perfectly honest with you. I'm also very impressed with how umpires react to the end of no-hitters. Humbert got a bizarre call at the end of his that saved the game. The strike zone expands to the size of roughly Vermont in the last inning of a no-hitter. And Jared Weaver has had the stuff to do this all along. So, I mean, this was a surprise and a delight, but less surprising than it was delightful.
And I understand that Weaver's no-hitter ended on a fly ball that was about 470 feet long. Happily, the fence was 475 feet away.
You have to use the whole ballpark, Bill. That's the key.
All right, it's Derby Day, and you've never picked a winner, as far as I know, but give it another shot anyway.
Well, the horse that I'm picking, which will probably lose and retire and become a Hare Krishna in the backstretch, is Union Rags, who I really think is a terrific horse.
Masters champion Bubba Watson has, quote, snubbed the PGA's $9.5 million Players Championship to spend some time with his wife and his two-month-old son. And I use the, quote, snubbed because some people are just appalled by this, and I'm not, and I don't know whether you are or not.
No, he has a wife and a two-month-old son, and he's the Masters champion, okay? He's already had a pretty good spring. Why he needs to go, you know, parade around the glorified pitch and putts course that is the TPC is beyond me. I think he should stay at home and tickle his little son on the chin and do, who's the Masters champion? You know, I think that's a perfectly good way to spend a weekend. Ooh, the son of the Masters champion. Ooh, the son of the Masters champion.
And finally, Charlie, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, the inspiration and location for Slapshot, arguably the best sports movie of all time, as far as I'm concerned, will be getting a new hockey team. The Junior League franchise needs a new name and a new logo because Jets and Chiefs are apparently off limits due to copyright issues. So, you got a suggestion for them?
Well, there's only one option, is there? They have to be the Johnstown Hansons.
That's what I said, the Johnstown Hansons, absolutely.
And they could have give out horn-rimmed glasses as a special once a season.
You can find Charlie Pierce's sports writing at Grantland, among other places. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
After I've spoken to groups at libraries and elsewhere, I always invite questions and comments, and I often get the same sad story. It's the story of a man whose shoebox full of baseball cards was thrown out by his mother or his wife or some other thoughtless person with access to the shelf in his closet and neatness on her mind. I've grown tired of smiling through these stories, and at a speaking engagement the other night, I had the opportunity to respond with something other than the phony smile. You were lucky, I told the guy who said he'd lost his Yankees cards to an energetic cleaning lady. What? He yelped. Look, I said, what did you probably have? A Horace Clark, doubles of Fritz Peterson, maybe a Mickey Mantle from late in his career when everybody had a couple Mickey Mantles? His sheepish smile told me I had his shoebox about right. So if you still had that stuff and you took it all to the memorabilia place, they'd give you $20 for the lot if you threw in the box. Oh, said the guy. But the shoebox is gone, so it could have had anything in it. A Tris speaker, a Ty Cobb rookie card. I didn't have those, the guy said. I know, I told him, but don't you get it? You don't have your old baseball cards, but the absence of them means you have a story. You can tell everybody you lost millions on account of the cleaning lady. How do I know my suggestion made the guy whose baseball cards were gone forever feel better? Simple. As I was leaving the hall that night, I overheard the conversation he was having with another guy he'd collared at the back of the room. Or, at least, I heard fragments of it. Something about Tris Speaker and Ty Cobb.
I'm a baseball card lover. Ooh, I'm a baseball card lover. I'm a baseball card lover. Show me your cards.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Of that, I'm quite sure. I also pretty much always remember my wife's name and the names of my daughters. Beyond that, wait, what was I talking about? I know I was going somewhere with this. Bah, forget it. Just roll the story.
You are Karen?
Yes.
Given?
Yes.
Okay, so that's an easy name, as obviously...
If you want to go where everybody knows your name, try the USA Memory Championship, held each March in New York City. They'll even teach you how to do it.
But let's say my name, Majid Fatouhi. That's much harder. So what you do is you try to come up something very close
to my name. Dr. Majid Fatouhi is the chairman of the Neurology Institute for Brain Health and Fitness. We decide that I'll be able to remember his first name by associating him with how much I like to drive my mom's Jeep. Majid equals my Jeep. But his last name is harder.
So Fatouhi is F-O-T-U-H-I. I mean, some people would say like futon, uh-huh. Right? So you think of your Jeep running into a futon. The funnier it is, the more likely it is you remember. The trick, if you want to call it a trick, is to visualize everything, make them funny, and make a story out of it.
Mental athletes, as they're called, don't have photographic memories or off-the-chart IQs, but they have trained their brains, just like athletes train their bodies. Over the past few years, defending champion Nelson Dellis memorized people, actions, and objects to represent numbers. Earlier today, when recalling 303 random numbers, a new U.S. record, he just visualized a string of moving pictures.
0030480, which is Jack Black, you know, actor, punching a tree. And then you had, following that was 9990704, which was Shredder, the bad guy from the Ninja Turtles, sipping on a martini glass which has like a glove in it. That's a lot more memorable.
Memory champions like Dellis have great imaginations. They're also physically fit. Strenuous cardiovascular exercise increases the size of the hippocampus, the part of the brain most responsible for memory. To keep his mind and body in shape, Dellis climbs mountains, big ones like Mount Everest.
Mental athletes, please put the cards in front of you, face down.
Nearly four dozen competitors wear blue T-shirts with slogans like, I'm a mental athlete. Ask me about docosahexaenoic acid, supplied by the event's sponsor, a memory supplement manufacturer. A few are wearing noise-reducing earmuffs. Only one is wearing a wide-brimmed white cowboy hat, and his name is...
Ronnie White. I'm not good with names.
Actually, Ronnie White is very good with names. He regularly memorizes 150 or more as an opening demonstration at the memory seminars he's been teaching for 21 years. He hasn't been doing this event for nearly as long.
In 2004, 2005, I first heard about this competition. I'm like, oh my God, those guys are freaks of nature, savants. But then it started in the back of my mind, I teach this for a living. If I don't compete with these guys, then I got to stop being introduced as one of the top memory experts in the country.
White won the title in 2009 and 2010, but lost it last year to Nelson Dellis. Today, while Dellis is swarmed by media, his face set in a permanent scowl of intense concentration, White is the only guy in the room who looks like he's enjoying the competition.
My number one goal this year is to have fun. And to ensure that I have fun, I put gummy bears and Doritos in my underwear. Oh, I did too. Look, their Doritos are falling out.
Despite the escaping snack chips, or maybe because of them, Ronnie White is in fourth place after the preliminaries and joins his fellow top eight finishers on the stage for the elimination rounds. First, they memorize a string of random words. Then it's time for a tea party.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Gray Schneider. My date of birth is April 22nd, 2003.
One by one, guests introduce themselves to the competitors who take notes and head backstage for 15 minutes of memorization. It's just enough time for a former champion to wow the audience.
My name is Chester Santos, the International Man of Memory.
Chester Santos won this competition in 2008. Now he promotes memory improvement and mental fitness by demonstrating his ability to recall the names of 535 members of the House and Senate, their voting districts, party affiliations, and committees. It's 4,000 pieces of data, and Santos is perfect, if not quick, as audience members shout out names or district numbers.
California 30th District.
If you think the U.S. champions are impressive, Santos points to Wang Fing from China, who memorized 500 numbers in 5 minutes and 2,660 in an hour, both new world records at the World Memory Championships in December.
He's very famous in China. Not that many people have still heard of Chester Santos. I was on CNN when I won, but, you know, the average baseball player, people know more about them.
Only one competitor is eliminated in the tea party round, leaving four to face the final challenge. Two full decks of cards memorized in 5 minutes.
Queen of clubs.
Okay, Nelson's back to you.
Ace of hearts.
Defending champion Nelson Dellis answers quickly and confidently as the other finalists struggle. Before long, it's down to just Dellis and Ronnie White.
So either this is where the cowboy rides away, or this is the seven of clubs.
It was not the seven of clubs, so Ronnie and his white cowboy hat leave the stage. Even though he's already won, Dallas runs through the entire second deck of cards just to show that he can. Tony Dottino, who co-founded the U.S. Memory Championship 15 years ago, is pleased at how far the competition has come.
When we started our first year, we couldn't get past the 25th card. So that if you go from the beginning, did I ever think I'd go through two decks? My first prayer was, could we get through one?
Dottino says at the beginning, the biggest challenge was finding people willing to put their brains to the test. Now, the competition attracts software engineers, accountants, administrative assistants, high school students, and even a few of their moms.
They're not freaks. They're not nerds. They're people who have learned how their memory works, and they've taken the time to exercise it. Anyone can do this, given the right coaching and the right desire to practice.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. Thanks to Jeff Smith at Nebraska Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's Memory Championship photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from memory champion Ronnie White. You remember, the guy with the things in his underwear.
Now, next time I'm not going to do gummy bears because they get hot and they stick to you, and I didn't realize that before.
Oh, if I had a nickel for every memory athlete who didn't realize that a candy made primarily of gelatin would get all sticky in his pants. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from Valvoline, maker of next-gen motor oil, engine protection with oil made from 50% recycled stock. Learn more at Valvoline.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. And the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.